Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss why we use music in psychedelic-assisted therapy. We explore the evolutionary origins of music, the evocative and transcendent effects of music, how music shapes the psychedelic journey, what goes into constructing a playlist for psychedelic-assisted therapy, what to do when a client doesn't like the music that you've chosen, the opportunities and challenges of using silence in psychedelic therapy, contemporary and ancient approaches to pairing music with psychedelics, and much, much more. Got a couple of announcements for you before we get into the episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, you can check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you've listened to the show for a while, you've heard Reed and I talk about the psychedelic clinical trial work that we do here at Numinous. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support us, you can do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you enjoy the episode, please share it with somebody that you think might find it interesting. Without further ado, here's our episode today about music. Good morning, Reed.
Good morning. It is morning, isn't it? This is different.
We don't usually record in the morning, but I'll try to sound more chipper than I feel.
Let's wake up.
Yeah. You were saying before we recorded that we should have done like a cold plunge or something to excite the senses. But there are other things that excite the senses. Our topic today about constructing a playlist for psychedelic therapy, or at least more generally speaking, why is it that we use music when we are using psychedelic tools for transformation? I've heard it said that music can be the wind in the sails of a psychedelic journey. I kind of like that metaphor. It can be, we'd probably come up with other metaphors, maybe the rudder. Music, different songs create different chapters for a lot of folks in the psychedelic journey space.
Mendel Kaelin, a researcher who was at Imperial, now founded WavePaths, a platform for psychedelic therapy music. He calls it the hidden therapist, even in one of the scholarly papers on the topic. I like that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a curiosity to me, if not a pet peeve or soapbox item, this question of why don't we talk about this more? Music, why don't we focus on it more? Because in a psychedelic therapy session these days, it is really the only stimulus that we keep there. Like, we give eye shades, noise canceling headphones, a recliner to be comfortable. So we silence ourselves so the person can go inward, and yet we give them a playlist. So if you think about it that way, why would it be then an afterthought of like, oh no, we got to find a playlist on Spotify for this session and not like one of the main considerations?
I've thought a lot about that with our clinical trials, right? When you're doing a clinical trial, you're doing a research study, you're trying to control for all the variables you can so that you know what to attribute the change to, which variables to attribute the change to. And you're right. So, I mean, the playlists that are cultivated for these trials are consciously cultivated, but...
And consistent, even though you can skip, we're instructed to use this playlist, start at the beginning of a session and let it ride unless there's a reason to intervene.
Yeah, but there's so much that goes into a particular song or the progression, like the sequence of particular songs, that, I mean, it's probably impossible to control for all those variables, but it, I mean, just to your point about your soapbox, it's such a huge lever. Like the, if you were to control all the variables and have everything the same, but just change the music playlist, this person could have a completely different experience.
Yeah, very much so. And, research or the psychedelic kind of community, both in the underground and in the academic research labs and everything in between, you know, we are deconstructing, you know, music as one of the big variables in there, or as the hidden therapist, at least starting to, there's a lot of good work being done on creating the arc of a journey by choosing different kinds of music for different parts of the journey, like mm-hmm. an opening, a supportive, grounding initial chapter so you can feel safe, and then more of a challenging or songs with more emotionality, provocative. And if you've used the Wave Paths platform just as an example, this is part of their playlist, and you can pick different songs or lengthen different chapters, and you do, depending on which medicine you pick in that platform. And then there's also a bunch of other groups working on it, like in Copenhagen. We used that playlist in Jamaica when we took a group out there for a retreat mm-hmm. last year, right? Mm-hmm. I really like how they not only made a playlist, but justified it by the ranking and deconstructing the emotionality of each song and mapping it over the journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it fascinates me because to rank and deconstruct the emotionality of a song is somewhat of a subjective endeavor, right?
And
I mean, there are some fairly universal principles, like certain keys, certain chord progressions evoke certain emotions. Most people wouldn't say that. I'm not a music expert, but like a minor key versus a major key or whatever.
Yeah.
That they do tend to evoke certain kinds of emotion states, but some of it's subjective.
And to focus on that just for a moment, because I think it's intriguing, is, we can get into what's happening in the brain when you listen to music and why it moves us and all that. But the emotionality evoked by music, like you mentioned, a major chord, which is what on a major scale would be 1, 3, and 5 of the white keys on a scale, for example. And then if you just shift one of those to one of the black keys on the piano, you have a minor chord, which are considered the sad chords. Mm-hmm. And, the major chord has more of a easy to process harmony, or the mm-hmm. harmonics of it, by nature of that chord, land a certain way in the brain. And the minor is more complex because you've shifted something and then requires more processing. That's one way people think it might be evoking a different response. And even in our voices, when you're talking about something sad, it gravitates more towards the minor sad chord, like auditory signal. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's like music itself is a language. So you talk about it being the hidden therapist. There are a lot of people who enjoy music or who play music, produce music, will talk about music being central to sort of human communication.
Yeah.
And it maybe even older than spoken language, right? That we were banging on drums and grunting and things like that.
Yeah, and I feel like I should make a disclaimer because I know I'm jumping into this eager to geek out on the science of it, but I just want to say that, like, I'm doing this just to catch up with the age-old wisdom that I've experienced in ceremony, where my mind and heart were blown by the music experience and what it evoked. And I think we're making a case for being more conscious and aware of the role of music, admitting that we don't understand, and the age-old traditions predate even science, right? Or the ability to try and make sense. But I think it's worth really putting some time and energy on in this era of psychedelic therapy, for sure.
Yeah, and music, you could make a claim that is an ancient technology, that, like I said, an ancient language, that we don't fully understand how or why or what it evokes in us.
Yeah.
So to combine it with these powerful tools, these powerful medicines, that are mind manifesting and soul manifesting, creates an incredible synergy.
Yeah.
Where, the sum is more than just the constituent parts.
Yeah. So we're talking about, like, why is music interesting to psychedelic therapists or people, why should we care? But another fun angle on that question that I'm curious what you think about is, like, why are psychedelics interesting to musicians, music researchers, scholars, and music therapists, perhaps?
Yeah, because there's all these fun stories about some of the best music that's ever been created being, we suspect or we know, created by people who are experiencing psychedelics, right? The whole Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds phenomenon. But Why is it interesting? I think a lot of the very, very creative folks probably have more neuroplasticity than those of us that aren't as creative. They're in a kind of perpetual psychedelic state because parts of their brain communicate in ways that the neurotypical folks don't. And, you know, I've heard musicians who walk around with sort of permanent synesthesia, and they can sort of see sounds and taste colors and all these things. So it doesn't surprise me that somebody who is deeply emotional, deeply creative, in a way that can create this unique language of music might also be interested in the psychedelic state. But I think for me as a psychedelic therapist, I'm really interested in music just because I've seen the playlist be the other therapist in the room. And I'll be with a client who is listening to the curated playlist that we've chosen for the session, and they're having an evocative emotional experience, and I'm tempted to make assumptions about what they're experiencing. Like, I'll be listening to the song too, and it's evoking something in me, and I'm not on drugs. And then I'll be like, this is evoking something a little uncomfortable in me. And I wonder what's going on for them. And then we'll check in, you know, either later in the debrief or sometimes in that moment if they need support. And my assumption will have been wrong. You know, they're whimpering a little bit. And we check in later, and the whimpering was, a whimpering of joy, of the release that they've been holding up this energy for so long. And I was assuming they were just super sad or struggling. So that's, one of the reasons I'm particularly interested, because it's this other force that is helping in a synergistic way with the medicine, my client achieve something that we couldn't achieve in regular psychotherapy.
Yeah. And music has always been interesting to therapists for that reason. Or, you know, traditionally in the therapy world, you might get prescribed listening to a sad song or two daily to have a good cry, for example. Or I've been in retreat settings where, you know, totally independent of the psychedelic journeys, as part of integration circles, you know, we would introduce music related to, you know, that would, you know, evoke emotions and help something stick that we were all kind of experiencing together in someone's group process. Yeah. And it was beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Music independent of the medicine can be a psychedelic experience.
Yeah. And because it is, like you mentioned, it's this fascinating ancient technology, or this complex interplay between like these signals outside of us that come in, like the vibration sound waves, you know, hit the eardrum and the cochlea in the middle ear and its chambers of different stiffness, and going to this, like, what is it called? The organ of Corti in the inner ear. And then eventually, you know, traveling on these nerve pathways to the auditory cortex, but then it connects to memory, autobiographical memories, emotion processing, joy, sadness, etc. And you could see why, it could be a damn good tool to, even in a controlled way, to go into that space or to let yourself feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way you described that made me think of music being an access portal to the subconscious because of how evocative it can be. Evocative of emotion, but like you mentioned, memory.
Yeah.
Because a lot of what we're trying to do in psychotherapy and psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is get access to those unconscious parts and processes that are either self-defeating or complex or confusing or stuck. And so, like, it's another way to sort of sneak in the back door of the subconscious mind.
And, I want to highlight something else you mentioned that I think is important, is your assumptions are often wrong of someone's experience. And a related idea to point out, I think, is that there's no one size fits all playlist, right? We could
try. Some funny stories about that.
We could try to, and let's get into them, because we could try till we're blue in the face to have that perfect playlist. But you know, every human is so unique in their own way. And things like lyrics may be too evocative or too autobiographical or nostalgic or too tied to language, which is grounded in your everyday reality, where some people gravitate more towards like non-lyrical or maybe lyrics that aren't very well understood or in a different language, but then you can enter into different territory of like cultural differences mm-hmm. in what music might be best suited for an individual. So another caveat is just to take these as principles and concepts and know that you really have to first and foremost consider your client or your group.
Yeah. So much we could talk about there. So I'll just follow one thread. There is, I think, an argument to be made about collaboratively co-creating the playlist with each client.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if somebody's psychedelic naive, they might have some music that they like, but, they're not necessarily going to know in every case which songs or which playlist is going to be the most helpful therapeutically. So that's why I think it's, you know, collaborative. You as the therapist with experience, might have some ideas about the playlist. Like you mentioned, lyrics or no lyrics, mm-hmm. The cultural roots of a particular song. I remember in a ceremony once, somebody played that Sitting Around the Fire mm-hmm. song with, it's got, you know, Ram Dass speaking over, I think it was John Hopkins and East Forest collaboration. Yeah. And I remember hearing it come on and I love that. It's basically a sermon to music. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, this person in particular in this group, they need to hear this. This is really going to be helpful for them. And then shortly after it's over, this person goes, "Who the hell is that guy? Mm-hmm. He's talking about sitting around the fire. You idiots can sit around the fire. I got stuff to do. I got things to create." Uh-huh. So it was evocative in a way that I wasn't expecting, right? I was expecting this to be like, okay.
Triggers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to test them to the assumptions. But now my mind is grinding to a halt, but there's just so many different variables to consider when we're constructing the playlist.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, before we venture too far from it, I'm curious your thoughts on why music exists. Like, and there is a debate out there on the evolutionary roots, but it's fun to meander through wondering, why do you think music evolved? Because it is ancient technology. Like, I think the first, maybe even before tools, like the oldest instrument is a flute. Mm-hmm. The best the world knows it right now is this Neanderthal flute. It's on display in Slovenia and it's made from like a young bear's left thigh mm-hmm. with four holes drilled in it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly not an evolutionary psychologist or biologist, but my suspicion would be that there was toning and musicality to language before there were words, like before there was vocabulary. My guess is that music was the first way we communicated. One of the first ways we communicated before complex language. So why music? I think it was maybe, like, I'm just thinking out loud here, but maybe a way to communicate.
Yeah. Like, you can see how in tribes and groups, and you would use it to, both for social bonding and coherence and communication and calling to one another, but even in between groups or intergroup kind of evolutionary strength perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it is fascinating because there are a lot of, angles too, to take. Like, some would say there's this debate, like Steven Pinker wrote a book called How the Mind Works. Mm-hmm. He makes the case that, music isn't an evolutionary adaptation, but it's an exaptation, or a what you could call an auditory or an evolutionary cheesecake. Like the cheesecake as an example, because evolution favors the consumption of fat and sugar for a couple of reasons, but evolution doesn't really care if it's a cheesecake, but cheesecake evolved because it has those things. And did music evolve because it has these things like tone and rhythm and communication that affect our emotions and energy level and that we can use to communicate? It's all the devil's in the semantic details, mm-hmm. but I tend to think it's, you know, it evolved, you know, the way I view music is more of an evolutionary adaptation and not a accidental byproduct.
Yeah, that would make sense to me. I think sometimes of music as an intactogen. We talk about different psychedelics being intactogens, meaning something that helps you contact your inner world.
Yeah. That reminds me of my exposure to this fascinating kind of view on music, when I went to India and saw people chanting, mm-hmm. you know, mantras, kirtan, these sacred chants for hours on end to commune with the divine in groups of people, mm-hmm. or by themselves reciting things to kind of lose yourself and find the divine. And it turns out that, like, if you look at yoga, we see it in the West here as more of a posture thing. You mm-hmm. do your yoga poses, you get a workout, or you expand that a little. Some say, oh yeah, it involves meditation, breathing. Right. But people often leave out one of the biggest parts of it from, like, centuries ago, when these, like, sages called rishis in the mountains of India were making these systems of living to harmonize oneself with oneself and nature and the divine and each other. Like, that became part of it. It's a path of yoga that you could call bhakti yoga, or, like, communing with the divine through chanting or music, especially in groups. And that is thought by many to be the fast path of the heart to God.
Mm. Yeah, that word harmonize, I've used this metaphor on the podcast before. I use it with my clients a lot, but to think of oneself as a musical instrument that can get out of tune. And there's so many things in our environment that can help us get in tune, or things that we harmonize with or we aren't in harmony with, and we can bring ourselves into harmony with. But there's something about sort of the vibrations of musical notes that can feel harmonious or not harmonious with our mental state, our emotional state, our spiritual state. I don't necessarily know where I'm going with this,
yeah.
except to say that there's some, that I get back to the language aspect. There's deep, ancient, embedded in our genetic ancestral code, responses to music yeah. that I don't fully comprehend.
Like an entrainment. I'm into crystal bowls, right? I have a nice collection at home, and there's this little branch of yoga that you could call nada yoga, or the yoga of sound, that the whole idea is to bring harmony back, or bring what's in disharmony or disease into harmony through these sound waves that have an impact. Like, I've got tuning forks on the shelf over there that I got from med school, but in some of the spiritual conscious shamanic communities, those are also a tool for kind of, you know, embodied spiritual practices, right?
Yeah.
But so the idea being, like, if you've experienced crystal bowls, which many people have these days, they do slip you into somewhat of a trance state rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel it. It goes through your body. Like, you can, with those tuning forks, you put a tuning fork by your ear. You hear the sound waves going in your ear. You put it on a bone on your skull behind your ear, and you hear it through bone conduction.
Mm-hmm.
Some headphones work that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so like tuning your body. You mentioned the chanting. I've experienced chanting as kind of like a psycho-spiritual auger, where because of the repetitive nature of it, you just feel like it's drilling down and down and down. And if you allow yourself to follow it, you reach these sort of depths of here and now consciousness that are really hard to get to if you just sort of, like, think about it.
Right? Yeah. And I think it's important to point out that that process does take time.
Mm.
Like, you can train those pathways, you can slip in faster, you can slip in easier, like with medicines on board or in different situation sets and setting. But it is about the, like, we humans are just wired that way to need some repetition to quiet the monkey mind and get out of our head into the senses, and therefore connect with that divine, if you will, or to get into that transcendent experience with the monkey mind out of the way.
So my monkey mind is going back to your question earlier about why music and how music evolved and why we're fascinated by the combination of music and psychedelics. And the few experiences I've had with music and psychedelics, I remember feeling like I understood musicians better. And I don't call myself a musician. I played, you know, a string instrument in school and stuff like that. I love music, but I don't pretend to really understand music very well. But I remember listening to a song while on a psychedelic and just thinking, oh, I get this guy. Like, yeah. I don't necessarily, not that I could put it into words, but I felt a connection to the person who
Your
was making
mirror
the music.
Neurons lit up.
I guess. Yeah. And what I felt like I was doing is I was actually listening. Like I was listening with more than my ears.
Your whole
I was
self.
Listening with my whole self, yeah. with my heart, with like my soul, with my spirit. And I felt connected to this particular musical artist. And now when I listen to that song, I feel like I can kind of go back there.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have been able to find it without having that experience first.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to me that, I mean, they've done studies on this. They, whoever they is.
The proverbial they.
Like in a symphony, you go in there and there's this brain-heart coherence that starts to happen, slipping people into like a similar like brainwave state and even kind of heart electrical energy state, if you mm-hmm. will. And that's just listening. And then like music becomes really interesting when it's participatory too. Because mm-hmm. we are like, you know, babies can detect rhythm like almost from the get-go, mm-hmm. right? You know, everyone's seen a baby bust a move to a beat or something,
right.
but there's
yeah.
there's something universal. Oh, that reminds me, and I'm just going off on random tangents nonsensically here, but
well, we should rename the show Random Tangent.
Random Tangent
like
show.
A lot.
But there's this theory of evolution that and music that says that it evolved when humans became bipedal, like when humans started walking on 2 feet. All of a sudden, there was less of a noisy mess they were making as they crawled through the forest to attack their prey or get to one place or another. And then you could start to more easily synchronize two humans walking together. And you could have more periods of silence, like by yourself or with other, that was evolutionary, potentially advantageous to hunting and things like that. And stillness and introspection and creativity, just all these fun dueling theories. But, you know, and when I encounter those, I just like to, well, enjoy them and remember that more than one thing is often true too.
Yeah. I like this idea of synchronize. You know, you talked about the participatory nature of music, but my mom, it was really important for her kids to have the ensemble experience. So she encouraged us to play string instruments so we could play in an orchestra to be part of a greater whole. And I remember doing that in high school and, you know, we were high school orchestras, so we weren't amazing, but when we were playing our parts well, it was a special kind of team experience.
Yeah.
And you really did feel like a greater whole. Or in a choir. I remember our a cappella choir instructor in high school, he wanted to try this little experiment where we, instead of singing out loud, we just thought in our minds the song, and then we all vocalized the last note of the song.
Cool.
And we were in harmony. Like,
yeah.
just by doing it in our minds. So this sort of coherence that you were talking about, it's I don't know if it transcends or it subverts, but it's on some kind of mental, energetic, whatever level that is non-conscious. And again, I think that's why one of the many reasons why psychedelics and music play so well together. They're so synergistic.
Yeah. And there are a couple studies I bookmarked just for fun that kind of speak to that. Like there was one where they gave 10 people LSD. Then they listened to, 5 different tracks and instrumental ambient ones, filled out surveys about them. And there was a placebo group versus the music group. And you know, even in a small sample size, there was a significant, finding in the music group of more transcendence, wonder, feelings of tenderness, like powerful feelings and sensations, because music by itself without a medicine recruits all these areas like we've talked about, not just auditory perception but emotion, memory, mm-hmm. narratives about ourselves, and meaning making. Mm. And then, so you add that with a psychedelic that is kind of a complete sensory experience in a different kind of way, mm-hmm. this sensory and mystical experience. And you have music that does that same thing in different ways. There is a special kind of synergy there.
Yeah. Kind of exponential synergy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does make me think of the sort of the so-called Terence McKenna heroic dose approach, where he says, you know, 5 dried grams in silent darkness. I imagine there is a lot to be gained and experienced with psychedelics without music in mm-hmm. silence. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I love seeing that acronym written in any context, because it's a fun part of psychedelic history. 5-DSG-I-D, mm-hmm. right? If I said it right.
Something like that.
5 dried grams in silent darkness. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it's kind of the other side of this debate. And I draw a lot of parallels between psychedelic therapy, musicology, or playlisting and yoga, mm-hmm. for example, because, you know, back in the day when I was teaching a lot of yoga, I would spend a lot of time, as much time as I'd prep on anything, is making the playlist or the arc of the experience. Remind me of the question. I'm losing my train of thought. It's so early in the morning.
The 5, like, no music versus music.
Yeah, yeah. So, but there are a lot of schools of thought that just say no music. And most of the yoga I practice comes from that tradition. Like Ashtanga is a counted kind of approach with your breath as the music. And same with some of the Hatha variations, although people will do different, music spins on it for fun. So it's fun to explore the difference. But I've had people, I've had ketamine clients who just like to be in silence. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the noise canceling headphones are on, but it's like just nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to that when you take out all the senses, and like you're in a sensory deprivation tank, for example, or deep meditation or psychedelics in silence, where you can really see what's in the mind. And sometimes music is really helpful to evoke certain memories and emotions. But like, I think there is something, Terence McKenna was on to something for sure, of mm-hmm. that silent darkness, high dose approach, where the music just comes from within.
Yeah. Music comes from within. I am really curious about the differences. Cause we talk about, like I began by saying, music being the wind in the sails, or different songs creating different chapters. I had a psychedelic therapy client once say that like each song was an entirely different journey in and of itself. So when you don't have those markers for chapters, what does your mind do? Mm-hmm. Where do you, what places do you go when it's just you and the medicine without these other, you could call them guardrails or stimuli or different guides?
Yeah.
The music itself can be a guide to the psychedelic experience, a way shower.
Totally. And because we were talking about our retreat, legal psilocybin retreat, and having had some psilocybin experiences out there, mm-hmm. I think I can comfortably share a couple that get to that question of the 5 dried grams, because I've taken 5 or 10 dried grams before in silence. And it was fascinating to me. This happened on multiple occasions where one of the first parts of the journey was a lot of noise from within my mind. Mm. Like it was striking, almost this chaos noise or screaming or purging of noise. No one else could hear it, mm-hmm. but then it passed. And then on the other side of that was where there was like this kind of transcendence to a mystical, beautiful other side of that. It's almost like I had to get some of the default world chaos out of the way to get to that place. And it really seemed to parallel a lot of journeys we've seen in our clients of, you got to do some clearing first.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting that happened in silence.
Yeah.
Because I've seen it happen with the music. in my clients where that, where there needed to be a, well, I had one client describe it as a release, as a purge, you know, and it, there was a lot of fear associated with the tension first and, some resistance. And they described the music as helping them through that resistance, like kind of follow the music. And it wasn't until after they cried it out for an hour that they found the insight, the bliss, their true self. But in their case, the music they felt like was helpful to that end.
Yeah. And I love how it's, done looking at different traditions. Like we've been in ayahuasca retreats together before where there were distinct chapters of the kinds of music, like
Icaros and drums and
like Shipibo chants that are really kind of more of that evocative, like some would call it like jackhammer and using the music to really get in there. And then the, like the Lakota more lullaby style, and then the drumming, moving, chanting, releasing. And then just kind of mind blowing, wondrous, ecstatic bliss.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting to see different, with ayahuasca in particular, different traditions and approaches. And as ayahuasca has found its way up into the, modern Western, you know, Northwestern world, interesting to see different music, you know, in contrast to what you just described, something like Shipibo chanting, you've got electric guitar or, you know, more sort of modern
speakers.
But yeah, I mean, it seems like depending on the psychedelic, it'll take whatever sort of music is offered and make use of it.
It's an amplifier. So I've got in front of me here a table from that Copenhagen paper that goes through the arc and chapters of a journey. If you want me to list them off, you can jump in and add some commentary if you'd like.
Sure.
But so the first category is supportive, like we're talking about, but the first subcategory is supportive and safe. So music that's more reliable, predictable, without surprises, if you will, take you by the hand, lead you gently. And the simplicity is, there's more simplicity in these elements and form, maybe a solo instrument or a couple, rather than that kind of orchestra going at it together. So it's kind of lightening the mood, but not going too hard at it.
Yeah, sort of gentle.
And then there's more of a supportive and opening chapter, music that can open you up like one or two tiny surprises with dialogue and instruments, maybe a couple themes in the song. This is the way they deconstruct it, and they give examples of that, like specific songs. And there's some whole like taxonomy. They rated these and everything. The best one can try to like classify subjective things. Then you get into supportive and exploring music with some dynamic tension, complexity, texture, form, gives you the chance and still some support to surrender. And a possibility of exploring new territory. And then we're into the supportive / challenging territory where there's an explorative chapter with surprises and contrast, and it gets into explorative and deepening, inviting the listener into more of an emotional field, and holding them there, even though this can be challenging. Which we've seen that in sessions, music being so evocative that, someone is, you know, releasing emotions, crying, appearing to struggle. And it becomes a question for the therapist of what do you do? How do you approach that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, just to pick up on that point real quick, we have this default stance of curiosity, openness, in and through, surrender, let go. And generally speaking, I think that's the move. Again, back to what I said earlier, we want to be careful about assuming that we know what's going on for a person when they have these external displays of emotion. That being said, sometimes this particular stage in the arc of the psychedelic experience of inviting a person to really engage and to be challenged can be too much, right? We've talked a lot about on the show about pendulation, the window of tolerance.
You skip the safety section on your playlist or whatever.
So,
or it's just too triggering, too connected to life events, perhaps.
Which is why in preparation, we talk about what to do in these scenarios. The encouragement, I'm here, I'm going to keep you safe. I'm going to encourage you. We'll use our resources, our grounding. But if you find yourself really, really stuck in this place and it's just abject suffering, we can change the song. We can pause it. We can breathe. We can talk.
It's a nice tool to have and not overuse.
Yeah.
And really like leave the client in the driver's seat for the most part. I have had a situation or two where the client was so deep in it, you know, they didn't really know how to vocalize what they needed. And it took some like collaborative discovery of whether or not we should move on. But more often than not, I've found that clients will ask if like, can we stop the music for a bit? It's like, I'm going to explode to the rhythm of these drums inside me or something.
Yeah. I remember, a client and I had decided on a playlist but this client also had a few of their own songs that were just familiar songs that they asked me to sprinkle in. As I saw fit. And so,
cool. That's a lot of power.
It was cool. So I'm playing psychedelic DJ and, I decided to sprinkle in one of these songs and it was pretty apparent once it started playing that it was not consistent with the general tone of the playlist we had chosen. So it was a fairly stark shift. And about halfway through the song, my client's like, can we go back to your music? This isn't working. And later he explained it was too nostalgic. It was bringing in stuff into the journey that felt discordant with the direction that the very helpful direction the journey was taking him. But we had talked about that. Right. And so he felt empowered to make that request.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. I've had clients request or come in a million times with like their own playlist, but sometimes requesting a certain genre of favorite music. Like I'm thinking of one person who asked for all Hall and Oates and Simon and Garfunkel or something like that. And it's always interesting to me, like from that sitter standpoint of like, how's that going and how would it be in silence? How would it be with non-lyrical or something completely different? And I think one of the principles that comes out of this like academic, this attempt at deconstructing it is you know, we do want to explore new lands on a psychedelic journey. And there can be a lot of value in the familiar and comfort, especially in that safety and kind of gathering resources stage. But I do think there's something to exploring kind of uncharted territory or different music than you might listen to on your everyday drive. Even if you do revisit this music as part of your integration, this special music.
Yeah. I'm beginning to think there's no right way to do this, but there's wisdom, and maybe strategy. Because I have had clients who bring in particular songs because those songs are going to be evocative. Right. Like, I used to listen to this song when I was a teenager and I was going through some really hard stuff. It's going to help me bring up the things that I'm having a hard time addressing in regular therapy.
Yeah.
It's more than just like, oh, I really like Sheryl Crow. Can we listen to her latest album or whatever?
Yeah.
But we'd use that particular music because it's connected to memory. So there are pros and cons, different strategies to using novel versus familiar music. But I do find I use a particular playlist for a lot of my psychedelic therapy clients that it's really never gone wrong. And it's music that I had never heard any of the songs. And none of my clients have been like, oh yeah, I've heard that song before. And they've all had different experiences with the music and a lot of them surprising to me, but it's all been novel.
Yeah.
And then I did have one ketamine client who brought in some really, really, what I would describe as like heavy metal, like not something death I would miss. Yeah. It was kind of like a death metal kind of thing. And he's like, don't judge me, bro. This is just, this is what I like to listen to.
You were so judging. Just kidding.
I was judging thoroughly. No, I was curious to see what would happen, but for this person, that was what helped him.
I remember once, just down the hall from where we're sitting, having a ketamine group. This is when we were doing, an IFS ketamine group cohort. Mm-hmm. And, like we, as co-therapists got, excited about this, new musical adventure for this particular session of Cigarose Jonesy and like all these like wild and crazy emotional transformative journeys potentially. But it was like one or two songs in and someone like sits up from their ketamine and is like, can we change the music? So, I've had that feedback plenty where, you know, there is no right answer like you're pointing out. And it does require like just, kind of a humility and, a constant stance of learning, and because there's a lot of trial and error. Like I've had some ketamine playlists where, or psilocybin playlists where there was an opera song in the middle of it, and I had so many people just like come out of their inner space and be like, "What is this?" Mm-hmm. And you know, you could see from this taxonomy and deconstruction we're reading or looking at is, you know, that can be good. The triggers can be good, but you can go overboard with it.
Yeah, I had an experience in one of our clinical trials where, you know, we didn't get to construct the playlist. The study sponsor did. And this particular trial participant, and these are placebo-controlled trials, so I don't necessarily know that they got the medicine, but they were silent for like 4 hours, just internal, silent, I'm assuming following the music. Finally, they come out and, you know, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting to hear what their experience is like. And one of the first things they say is, this music is sinister. I wouldn't waterboard somebody to this. Like, what are you guys doing with this playlist? And I was like, wow. Yeah. Okay. Wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, it does bring out things or mm-hmm. amplify like psychedelics do, like music can, like what's in the psyche. And it does highlight kind of some of the things swimming around in there. And that's really, really interesting and a tricky territory you have to, mm-hmm. to navigate, because some music you could consider sinister, mm-hmm. but, there's often, like a general consensus with a lot of exceptions on those kind of things. Like your heavy metal client example, mm-hmm. like he has a different, preference of music and that was a unique experience for that client mm-hmm. that you hadn't got from that playlist otherwise.
Yeah. And not since. So we just took the opportunity to kind of like you're implying, explore their particular reaction to that particular music playlist and get curious about it.
Yeah. When we were in Jamaica, you know, we had our playlists, like these ones we're talking about and drawing from, but there was also, some kind of sound bath, live music, chanting, more kind of indigenous and traditional stuff dished out. And to be honest, I found that the most evocative and the mm-hmm. hardest to pinpoint and understand, because it's comes from these traditions that are just like beyond our understanding and mm-hmm. more of a mystery. But it was striking to me, just the kind of the visual and emotional and evocative experience that came from some simple repetitive chants and sounds.
Yeah, there's probably a difference between popular music and music that was created for the purpose of healing, for the purpose of excavation, you know, for the purpose of evoking non-ordinary states. So you've got these traditions that have developed these musical techniques and chants and approaches that are really for that purpose. Because mm-hmm. I've had a similar experience in Jamaica to that particular music. It's like, well, this is different. Yeah. This is different than Imagine Dragons, right? Like,
think about the Marsh Chapel experiment, mm-hmm. or which, you know, for those who may not be familiar, it was the Harvard Divinity School back in the 50s. There was an experiment done where a reverend pastor gave a sermon, and there was a choir, and half the people were on high dose psilocybin, half on placebo, of these divinity student study volunteers, and it was a profound mystical experience, heavily influenced and tied to the music and the sermon, and very, very profound. I think we've cited that before, that mm-hmm. Rick Doblin's PhD thesis did a follow-up surveying these people, and it's fun to look at because a significant number, like 8 or 9 out of 10 of those who got psilocybin ended up going on to become like pastors or in this divinity profession, compared to a much lower number in those who got placebo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was music that was, you know, familiar to them, right? This is, I'm not exactly, I don't know the exact, you said it was like hymns and,
like imagine sitting in a cathedral and listening to Ave Maria, like transcendent by itself, right? Kind of, you were talking about music that's created for a purpose and a lot of musicians, if you ask them why they're doing that, you know, you get different answers of, you know, who it's for and what it's for, but that's a common theme is like, you know, created for this, or you make scores of music as a composer for movies, certain parts of movies. But, yeah, imagine Ave Maria in a cathedral on 5 dried grams of mushrooms.
Right. Yeah. So music that was created for the purpose of communing with the divine.
Yeah.
So you might have some divine experiences with, and so that, like we were talking earlier, the there's different concepts of the divine, of course, in different traditions, but I imagine there's a lot of different roads that lead to Rome. But if, like I was saying earlier with my experience, feeling like I connected with the artist, if the intention behind the music is to help a person connect with God or God within, and you connect with that intention, I'm getting a little woo-woo here, but like, I think there probably is a difference between communing with or using music as a tool that was created, I don't know, just to entertain, versus communing with music that was created to for a purpose, and that you might sync up with that purpose.
We do a study of gangster rap versus versus
Ave Maria.
Yeah,
that'd be a fun study.
It would be, and there are so many unanswered questions, but so much kind of collective wisdom. In fact, that's another one of the evolutionary theories of music that I quite like, is intergenerational communication of stories, like ancestral passing of wisdom.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah. That is pretty cool.
Yeah, the ancestral gifts, the wisdom that can be passed on, and music does, we know from the studies, accelerate learning, not just language, but like motor skill, sports development, performance in many ways. So you could see how it kind of evolved as a booster to many things.
Mm-hmm. I like that, as a booster. So other things related to using music in psychedelic therapy.
Well,
what do you think?
To finish that Copenhagen deconstruction, the last part of it is the challenging section before bringing people back down to a grounding place.
Landing.
But in the challenging one, there's one that I like the title of. It's called The Rhapsodic Field. The music is a sequence of often unrelated or loosely related musical ideas, presenting many different moods, textures, tempi, and timbres. Ideas and elements can be quite elaborated or even improvisatory. Improvisatory. Yeah. How does one say that?
Improvisational.
And so then you're into the field of metamorphosis. Significant ideas elaborated in the shape and dynamics of the music, and that transform something from one thing into the next, kind of like this alchemical musical stage. And then comes the stage of mystery, where it's hard in their paper even to generalize this music, but it's often music that's intended to facilitate mystical states or transformation. And they gave examples of like Bach's Crucifixus, Rachmaninoff's Isle of the Dead, and Mahler's, that's in German, Der Abscheid.
Can't help you there.
Really fascinating work. Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. They've published that work and more recently, I think last year, a case report of how it went using it.
That's so interesting. So fascinating. So just some other just random thoughts for those of you who are curious about how to use music in psychedelic therapy. You know, most playlists, unless you've constructed it otherwise, there will be pauses between songs. And you can think of the pauses as rest breaks, as ways to punctuate the shift in chapters that each song can give. When I was earlier on in this work, when I was learning how to do it, I would get a little nervous about the silence between songs, thinking that I just needed to keep the music going. Like, it'll ruin the momentum if there are pauses between songs. But with more experience, I've learned that those pauses actually are really important. Because of the things I said, they can give a, if a song was particularly evocative, it can give a little bit of a trough as on the tail end of that peak, that emotional peak, allow them to get reacquainted with where they are, who they are without the musical guide or wind.
Yeah. There's an interesting debate on that too. In the field of, some platforms, approaches, playlists, even in studies, will encourage like a crossfading or like the wave paths will more flow one thing into the next. And it's a lot of it's AI generated music, by the way, in that platform, which is interesting. but yeah, it's one of those things that highlights the fact that there are no absolute right answers. And we're just sharing collectively this experience of learning together of how music plays a role, not just in the psychedelic session, but in the whole arc of from preparation through integration. But even more so, it helps us understand and see better the role of music in our lives.
Absolutely. So yeah, that was just my current opinion with those pit stops or pauses between songs. But back to our point about there's probably no exactly right or exactly wrong way to do this. You know, there are a variety of reasons why somebody might have difficulty with a particular song. We gave some stories and some examples, but this comes from psychiatrist Paul Yui, who taught the module in my MAPS MDMA training on music. And he gave us kind of this experiential session with listening to three different songs as we were in quiet reflection. It was really provocative. It was really cool. But he talks about three reasons why people might have difficulty with music. There might be an aesthetic misattunement. They just don't like that kind of music. There might be an affect or an emotional mismatch. You know, they went one place emotionally and this music is, you know, singing a different tune. And so that can create some dissonance. And then, like we talked about, psychological resistance. It's the music is actually helping them access something that's really difficult and they just aren't ready, or they don't feel well-resourced enough to go there.
Yeah, those are good points. I really appreciate Paul Yui's wisdom. He's awesome. One thing I want to make a plug for, because I went and experienced this past weekend, was... there's an ecstatic dance that's happening about monthly now in Park City. It's been on and off, but at a really cool space called the Yoga Shop or something like that. And the music was done this past weekend and will be every time for the next while by John Pattern. And if you look up John's music on Spotify, it's pretty amazing. He's a therapist who lives here in Utah. His name's John Patterson, and he goes by John Pattern. And I think his tagline on Spotify is something like "Change the Pattern." But it was really incredible how he kind of created this music for that purpose. Like, talk about, like you were mentioning, being a psychedelic DJ in sessions and. You know, when you're seeing a DJ in a concert or you're at a symphony or going to ecstatic dance, you're on a journey, or in an ayahuasca ceremony, there's live music and they're guiding you, like as your literal guide through their creative music process. And yeah, I'm excited to go experience that again and just wanted to make a plug for those in Utah to check out the ecstatic dance in Park City and John Pattern's music.
Well, you know, you sharing that made me think of the group synergistic experience that music can sometimes occasion.
Yeah.
Because we talked about jokingly the psychedelic DJ, but I've been at concerts with DJs, and the way they use the music, they can shift the entire energy of the collective, of the crowd. Mm-hmm. Like, just watch when the beat drops.
Oh yeah.
People, the anticipation of a beat drop.
They're playing with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're playing with your emotions, with your energy, and the tension that they build with, you know, a song that sort of is building to the beat. Everybody knows the beat's supposed to drop.
Yeah.
And then when it drops, people just lose their minds. Right. So I
ballistic.
I love the idea of music uniting us on some kind of transcendent plane where we're all sort of in it together. Even though we're individuals, there's sort of this interesting synergistic collective created by music.
Yeah. And it reminds me, and maybe this as one of the kind of closing thoughts to leave is in indigenous cultures, shamanic cultures, if you were feeling depressed, disheartened, you go to, say, a medicine woman, medicine person, and ask for help. Instead of immediately handing you Prozac, they would often say something like, "Okay, when did you stop communing with the divine? Singing, dancing, being enchanted by stories around the fire, and things like that." And in the sharing circle after this ecstatic dance last weekend, it was so neat to hear people one after another in their own way just share how they became like a kid again. It was so therapeutic. It was like got them out of their troubles and into their body and moving in an ecstatic way for a time.
Yeah. In the present moment, playful, disinhibited.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, in some languages, I forget which one right now, but I know I've heard of one at least where the word for music and dancing is the same. Hmm. They're not separable.
Yeah. There is certainly music that just makes you want to move.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to try. I keep promising and not delivering on trying yoga with you, but now I'm going to have to try. I'm going to add ecstatic dance to the list.
Sounds and there cool. was there was a little kirtan chapter afterwards in a circle of chanting together, call and response style. Like I was talking about earlier, this bhakti path, fast track to the divine, if you will. But I was playing with it in there. It was in this kind of this Om Namah Shivaya chant and variations on that theme where everyone was playing with their voice in a playful way together and in response to this guide. And if I'd close my eyes, I could literally just get lost. And it felt like we were just this... I don't know, this cluster of atoms whirling around making music in the spheres out there somewhere. And then I'd open my eyes, we'd be back there. Oh, we're all sitting in a circle. Mm. There's a harmonium there. But yeah, it was pretty trippy without from the music.
Trippy without tryptamines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool, Reed. Thanks for going on this musical psychedelic journey with me.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm sure many of you, the people listening will who know a lot more about music are probably shouting at their cell phones right now. You guys are getting it wrong, but...
We're trying. Yeah, no, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.